The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League comprehensive victory special. Manchester City see off Chelsea in a blistering first half. False nines, heavy pressing, De Bruyne on fire, how very 2018. Arsenal's youngsters pass their way through West Brom, how very 2013. And Leeds get picked off by one of the big boys, how very 2 weeks ago. Did they look a bit tired? Elsewhere, shock at Old Trafford as Manchester United get a penalty. It's good enough to beat Villa and take them top slash joint top slash actually second. Brighton score three in one game. Sheffield United don't score any. And Barry's title pick Everton stuff it up at Goodison. In Fitbar, Rangers have one hand on the title after winning the Old Firm without a shot on target. We'll have your questions, wonder what, if any, sanctions there should be for players ignoring COVID guidelines. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Nicholas writes, is this the dream lineup? I'd say for me, it is. Barney Ronay, how do you feel about being part of the dream Football Weekly lineup?
Max, every lineup's your dream lineup. I know what you're like. You charming, charming snake, you.
Oh, well, no, but I would say this is actually my favourite, especially until tomorrow. John Bruin, welcome to my dream.
Welcome to my nightmare.
And Barry Glendening, dream or reality, I don't know anymore.
Hello.
Question from Pete, who says, how much better is it having the Premier League be like the Championship, where a team can jump or drop four or five places with a couple of results? See Arsenal and Chelsea's recent fortunes, for example. John, how are you? Do you think this Premier League is sort of more exciting because of that?
Yes, I think I do, actually. Yeah. I mean, Christmas is always... it's a bit like a golf major where Saturday is moving day, and there is that, you know, that amount of fixtures are crammed in that teams can essentially make or break their season. And I suppose in the case of Chelsea, it's broken, and Arsenal are beginning to make something of themselves. And I've actually the last few rounds of games have been pretty decent, even though. Even in that round of games, which unfortunately for Amazon were all broadcast there, were quite dull, there were stories in every game, actually.
Chelsea 1, Manchester City 3 then. Feels, Barney, like this was the first time Man City have played like that. And when they get it right, it is so good, isn't it?
Yeah, they were really good. And, you know, it's been pretty obvious that Guardiola's trying to find a good balance in this team. He wants them to, in the same way Klopp did with Liverpool. He decided to make his team much harder to beat at one point after they'd been that kind of rampant, attacking team. And yesterday you saw them really hit a high gear. I thought it was very interesting. I mean, obviously they play without a striker, which I've always thought he secretly wanted to do forever. And Aguero's been this guy who's been sort of holding him back. Oh, come on, Pep, you know, play a proper striker. I'm really good. I'll score goals. And finally, he's getting to play, indulge his complete fetish for midfielders, which, sometimes when people go to an absolute extreme, it becomes a vice. But somehow with Guardiola, his most memorable teams are like that. And also, I thought it was interesting yesterday, someone noted in the comments on Guardian website that he didn't play inverted wingers. He played a left footer on the left and a right footer on the right. For the first time in a long time, I mean, that's not been their style. And it absolutely killed the Chelsea fullbacks. I mean, they were not used to this. Azpilicueta was suddenly being asked to defend against a proper left-footed winger. And he is an old, slow man now. I don't say that as a criticism. You know, I've been an old slow man for a long time myself. Has its benefits. Chilwell as well. You know, this rampaging modern fullback was being asked to defend against Raheem Sterling steaming down like a proper right winger. And that was very interesting. It created loads of space. They played on the counter-attack. They had less possession. But they were absolutely deadly when they attacked in that half-hour period. And it was great to see a really good manager showing what a really good manager can do. And you really felt Pep's, he loved it when he came off at half time and he was yammering in Foden's ear. It was like, look at me, I'm managing, it's all working. And I felt really pleased for him. You know, it was a man in his element.
John, which goal did you enjoy more, Gundogan's or Foden's?
Well, Gundogan's, it was a great finish, wasn't it? He sort of cut across the ball. But Foden's, I suppose, because of De Bruyne's almost impossible Zapruder film style, how did it get there, pass through, was it through the legs of Thiago Silva or was it
Azpilicueta?
Azpilicueta, yeah. To get there, it, what is described by in the cliched football journalism trade as an impudent finish by young Phil Foden. I thought Foden was excellent, showing signs of just why so many people have clamoured for him to play more. But De Bruyne, for some reason, Max, you didn't ask me about De Bruyne's goal, which I also thought was...
Okay, I can add it in the mix.
Sorry, John, that's the dumbing down of the pod.
It was great because of the fact that Chelsea seemed, you know, after Kante lost the ball, Chelsea seemed somehow to have just one defender against Raheem Sterling, who must be in the top five quickest players in the league. Sterling rather did and delayed, but still got a shot in. And then De Bruyne again, his finish was just so perfect for that situation. The first touch was so good, the calm, the finish. I'm sure we're going to get around to criticise Chelsea at a certain point, and they certainly deserve that. But all three goals, absolutely brilliant. That's why, sorry, Liverpool fans, at their best, Manchester City are the best team to watch in English football.
Defensively, City are much tighter as well. They've conceded the fewest in the Premier League, three in their last 11. Richard Jolly's first stat of the pod. John Stones went 808 minutes without conceding a goal. Callum Hudson-Odoi joins Raul Jimenez as the only player to score against the defence with John Stones in this season. And worth pointing out as well, Barry, that City were without Kyle Walker, Gabriel Jesus, Ederson, Ferran Torres, Eric Garcia, Tommy Doyle because of COVID. I mean, it was a statement, I believe, Barry. I believe other Premier League sides will... is it stand up and listen? What will they do?
Take notice, yes.
They will take notice of this performance, won't they?
Yeah, I would argue they didn't have a huge amount of defending to do. I think City started quite poorly. They weren't great for the first 15 minutes before that blitz where they just took Chelsea to school. But the reinvigoration of John Stones has been remarkable. I thought he was finished as a City player. I think he's had problems in his personal life that may have contributed to his decline in form. You know, him and Ruben Diaz have formed look a very solid partnership, and I think Stones is probably their first choice centre back at the moment. But yeah, I would add the caveat: Chelsea offered very little up front yesterday, so it wasn't a particularly tough day at the office for them.
Yeah, Marty says, will Frank Lampard be on Strictly in 2 years' time? 11 managers in 12 years for Chelsea, 4 points for the last six matches. I mean, but it's hard to play against Manchester City when they're playing like that, Barney, to mount some sort of defence for Chelsea.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've sort of made my view on it fairly clear. I think Lampard's pretty lucky to get the Chelsea job in the first place. I don't know what body of work his appointment was based on particularly, other than beating Leeds in the Championship playoffs and doing a dance. But obviously he's a club legend, and that's very important to Chelsea fans. I wouldn't disdain the fact that the people who support that club and go and buy tickets and watch really like this guy and want him to be in charge of their club. That's what football's supposed to be about. But some of his selections, you know, I really loathe to criticise managers because they know their players better than you do. They know football better than you do. Frank Lampard has lived this game from the age of six. You know, he does understand football really well. But there are then these odd moments where you suddenly realise that actually there are some things that this guy doesn't appear to be appreciating. And that's a moment where you feel that there's a bad fit. I mean, Lampard's, you know, eviscerating his players when it's quite obvious that there are things that are wrong with selections, with the way new players are all being... They're trying to embed these new players at the same time, and it's not really working. I went to the Villa game, And I thought Chelsea really, the players really did give everything there. I don't think the players are not giving stuff for him. I don't think it's anything to do with the players at all. I think that they look a bit bemused at times. And someone like Werner is being asked to do something different to what he did. He's come through German football. He's been coached by some brilliant managers. He's learned to play a certain way. There are certain spaces he wants to run into. There's a certain way that was really effective for him in the Bundesliga. And then you buy him and say, I want you to play a slightly different way as a kind of left-sided attacker. Should he change his entire game based on what Frank Lampard is telling him to do? Or should he remember the days of Ralf Rangnick that made him this fantastic £50 million player and wonder, why is this team not ready to accommodate what I'm really good at? It's a really difficult thing. I don't think he's managing that balance at the moment.
What I wonder is, would Frank Lampard, the senior Chelsea player, want Frank Lampard, this manager, in charge of him? And I don't think he would. I think he'd be agitating to have him got rid of. Because I think he is out of his depth. I've always thought he was out of his depth, the Chelsea manager. Now, there are certain things that he can't legislate for, says Azpilicueta's lack of pace, the fact that N'Golo Kante and Kurt Zouma were left hopelessly exposed yesterday. But he didn't do anything to try and fix those quite obvious problems during the first half, and then at half time he didn't make any changes, and you're kind of wondering, well, this is obviously going horribly wrong for you. Why aren't you doing something to try to fix it?
Barry, would you see it as like a sort of Back to the Future type scenario where Frank Lampard Jr. and Frank Lampard Sr., you know, young Frank Lampard is playing and Frank Lampard is the manager, but they can't see each other, like the doc can't see the doc, and there's a photo of Frank Lampard's face disappearing or appearing?
Sorry, was there a question there?
There was the dumbing down, Barney. It was right there at that moment. Now, Benjamin Mendy will be the subject of an internal investigation by City. They're disappointed at him for breaking COVID-19 isolation rules. He invited three people from outside his household to a New Year's Eve party at his house. Elsewhere, Sergio Reguilon, Eric Lamela, Giovanni Lo Celso and West Ham's Manuel Lanzini were pictured attending a Christmas party. Alexander Mitrovic and Luka Milivojevic filmed together on Instagram on New Year's Eve. Roy said, I know about it and obviously we condemn it. We're very upset about it. It doesn't do the image of the club any good. Mendy was on the bench for City. Reguilon was on the bench for Spurs. A Spurs spokesman said, we are extremely disappointed and strongly condemn this image showing some of our players with family and friends together at Christmas, particularly as we know the sacrifices everybody around the country made to stay safe over the festive period. The rules are clear. There are no exceptions. And we regularly remind all our players and staff about the latest protocols and their responsibilities to adhere and set an example. The matter will be dealt with internally. West Ham also said the club has set the highest possible standards with its protocols and measures relating to COVID-19. So we are disappointed to learn of Manuel Lanzini's actions. The matter has been dealt with internally. Manuel has been strongly reminded of his responsibilities. John, you've just had COVID.
Yes.
You were just telling us about it before. And I don't know if having it changes your opinion on what these players have done or not.
I'm not sure it changes my opinion. I certainly know. listen, I had what is termed as a mild case, but it didn't feel very mild, and it got pretty hairy at one point. But I am here, and I'm talking to you, and I'm very grateful for that. What I would say is, it didn't take me out, but it might take someone out who's a bit more vulnerable, a bit older. And in doing what they're doing, these players, they are putting other people at risk. At Crystal Palace, Roy Hodgson is a guy in his 70s, you know, and he might not be so lucky. I think in each case, they've chosen to ignore what is the guidance. Now, you mean you could say in this country that the guidance has been so confused, and we were supposed to have this great old Christmas in which we all partied together for 5 days and then went back to our lives. Thankfully, well, that didn't happen because things got out of hand before that. What you've got in football is something we've seen so many times, is that young people fail to take responsibility. The thing is that clubs don't seem to be sanctioning them for it. Pep Guardiola's comments after the game, well, not dissimilar to his backing of Bernardo Silva, in which he said, hey, Bernardo Silva's a nice guy when he'd committed a social media offence. He pretty much almost excused Benjamin Mendy, saying, well, other people did it. Well, I'm sorry, that's not the case. Manchester City had a game called off over Christmas because of COVID, yet he's willing to make excuses for him. I think Pep was hugely misguided in that, just as the players have been misguided in behaving like they have. It's a terrible situation. It's not a very nice thing to get. I don't advise it to anybody. But there comes a point, doesn't there, where should players who break the regulations be punished? Should there be FA sanctions? I think there's a case for that.
West Brom 0, Arsenal 4. Wonderful weather for football, Barry. Very upsetting there was no orange ball. Heads should roll amongst football's authorities. Mr. Butler says, Arsenal going down, 3 wins in a row, and they're going for Europe. Is Arteta a PE teacher or what? You guys in the media need to make up your minds and tell me what to think. What should Mr. Butler think?
I don't know what Mr. Butler should think. I suppose Mr. Butler should just accept that things change. Teams play badly for periods, then they improve. The transformation in Arsenal has been remarkable, and I think a lot of that is down to their manager, who, to an extent, has had his hand forced and was more or less forced through combination of suspension and injury to throw in some very inexperienced young players, and they've really done him proud and continue to do him proud.
Sure. Barney, would you like to rave about Bukayo Saka or Kieran Tierney or Emile Smith Rowe?
Yeah, I thought Smith Rowe was really good against West Brom, which is kind of, you know, being good against West Brom. But it's kind of performance he's been promising to produce. The goal, Saka's goal, was exactly what hasn't been happening at Arsenal, where he made a run that totally broke open the defence. It was like good Ozil. It was like Ozil with an engine, you know, like Ozil with a bit more testosterone. And it was exactly what they needed. And the pass at the end of it was lovely. And the fact that they're two kids who've, you know, come through the youth team together was a really beautiful moment for Arsenal. But I have to say, you don't get to play against Branislav Ivanovic every week. You know, West Brom were really, really poor. I don't know if you saw after Lacazette's second goal, the goalkeeper, Johnston, was doing gestures that took me back to Sunday league pitch. That where the space, like arms wide, like the space in front. I just, my flashbacks, my God, it's me. I'm there. I'm in that defence. And a fat bloke is telling me that I've not marked the space or whatever I haven't done. I mean, they were really, really bad. And those sort of young, energetic, you know, highly focused academy players who obviously really, Arteta's really got going, they just tore them apart. But that doesn't matter, that'll be really good for their development, really good for their confidence. And I just want them to keep playing now. They look really, really up for it. And Smith Rowe is exactly what they need.
Kieran Tierney's goal was beautiful as well, wasn't it? The third goal, I mean, it was just hilarious. Semi Ajayi had a really disappointing 30 seconds, didn't he, where he gave the ball away. And then he sort of tried to score an own goal with quite a cute volley into the bottom corner, which unfortunately didn't hit the post. It came back. The ball gets absolutely twatted into his, I mean, I wasn't sure, but let's say midriff. And then Lacazette scores. And you wonder if what Big Sam was thinking, John, as Ajayi had those 30 seconds. And to be fair, Ajayi, I think he's been one of West Brom's better players so far this season.
I think Big Sam is probably going to attempt his, well, make his latest attempt to get the season called off after that one. He was raging from about the second minute. You know, when they have TV pictures and after sort of a minute or so, they cut to the bench and, you know, there's a sort of atmospheric shot of what's going on there. Allardyce was already doing his nut, no longer wearing the mask somewhere around his chest. He's given up on that. He was very, very annoyed throughout this game, rightly so, because the players didn't do the Allardyce plan remotely. They didn't carry it out. He's got a real job on there. This season has already seen the latest fall of Tony Pulis. I'm beginning to worry about Big Sam, the old firm of managers. This might be the end of the road for them, because I don't really see a way back for West Brom from this point. And of course, Sam, deeply ironically, has been complaining that he hasn't been able to get certain players into the club due to the new regulations post-Britain leaving the European Union, something which he was an advocate of. I'm not going to say anything further than that.
Richard Jolly's second stat of the pod. Bukayo Saka, the first player born after Sam Allardyce first managed in the Premier League to score against a Sam Allardyce team. But yeah, he does have a job. And the thing I've noticed, you know, they're doing their virtual press conferences.
Yeah.
And most of the managers sound sort of quite muffled. Big Sam's microphone settings are so loud that it sounds like he's sort of broadcasting like a political address to like minute. And next time you hear it, it's like triple the volume of everyone else. And he's absolutely bellowing.
Also, have you heard his Brummy accent as well?
Has he gone more Brummy?
Well, you know, he's actually been born in Dudley, of course.
Yeah.
And he's returning home or near home. And he's suddenly speaking like Barry off Alfida St. Pat. It is... You know, I'm sure when Barry returns to his homestead, his accent thickens, and obviously Barney's kept it real and, you know, is a South London geezer when he's walking the streets. But, yeah, Big Sam is, you know, Tudor a bit and all that type of accent. It's absolutely amazing.
I can't criticise. Within 5 minutes in a taxi, I am basically a Cockney. I'm all apples and pears, I'd say, within 5 minutes. Spurs 3, Leeds 0. Big debate on the pod, Barney, before this game was whether Jose would manage to make it boring or Bielsa would manage to make it interesting. Which was it?
Well, I mean, I don't really go along with the boring thing. I quite enjoy that kind of attritional counter-attack football. I think it's quite a nice contrast. Leeds were always going to leave spaces that brutally, viciously efficient Spurs attack would exploit. They're the perfect team for Mourinho. If you want someone to run and leave some space, here you go. And incredibly, it's nothing new, but the telepathy between Son and Kane is reaching an extraordinary level. I mean, that is amazing. They are like playing through an incredible little period then. Obviously, one of them will soon get injured because that happens in football and that will derail that partnership. But their sharpness are just way too much for a team that leaves that much space.
Barry, did Leeds look tired?
Don't go there, Max. You get yourself in all sorts of bother. I don't know if they look tired. They just didn't play particularly well. They didn't defend well. They were a bit toothless up front and they were beaten fair and square. I'll be honest, I switched over at half time because I didn't really give them a prayer of getting anything out of the game, and I watched the second half of the FITBA, and from what I saw the second half highlights of Spurs Leeds, it was just a fair beating. They're capable of much better, and it was slightly disappointing that they didn't make a better fist of it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose Spurs had longer to prepare, didn't they? Because their game against Fulham was called off. John, on Heung-min Son, his 100th goal for Spurs in all competitions. And as Barney said, you know, the pass and the run and the finish and all those were beautiful. But he's such a ruthless footballer. I don't know where to put him on, you know. Is he on the top table? Is he on the second table? Or is he not quite? Where is he? It depends, I guess, on how big the tables you're having at this dinner that you're organising, John.
Well, we're not allowed to organise dinners anymore. Not even order your own chef in, as Benjamin Mendy did. Recently did The Guardian, you know, top 100 or top 40 or whatever, as we all did. Son was pretty high up for me. You call him ruthless, but he plays with such a smile on his face as well. Like, he enjoys playing. He celebrates goals with, you know, the smile of Clark Gable or something like that. He really, really enjoys playing. In that Spurs documentary, though, you know, when he injures his arm, doesn't he? And you see a side of him there, like his determination to keep playing and his anger at not being able to play. But with him, though, you are almost in the position of, like, he's so underrated that he's fully rated. There can't be anyone that thinks he's not a very, very good player, and an admirable second in command to Harry Kane. And as Barney said, what a combination they've got there. I was writing about it recently. I don't think that they've had that type of combination since like Alan Gilzean is headed it down for Jimmy Greaves to knock in. Both great to watch together. Jose Mourinho is a very lucky man to be able to work with them. I think he recognises that too.
Yeah, I mean, I think Son is underrated. I think he would improve any team in the world by going into them. And even though he might not, he's a sort of Salah type player, but he does think he doesn't score as many goals. He's not as wildly effective, but he does a lot of things Salah doesn't do as well. Any manager would take him. I think even the smile is a little bit misleading because, as you know, like in the flesh, he's imagine playing against him. He's so physically strong. He's sort of larger than you think, and he's at you all the time. He's a perfect sort of modern footballer. Like he's absolutely relentless and scores brilliant goals. I think he is. He's on that top table with Bernard Mendy's chef. You know, he's there. He's in that special place.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Old Trafford. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United 2, Aston Villa 1. United level on points with Liverpool. John, I thought a brilliant game. I thought the second half of this game was superb.
Yes, end-to-end stuff. At this point, a lot of Manchester United fans are getting excited. United fans are flowing with optimism, and rightly so, because you know a lot of their players are playing well. Bruno Fernandes is turning into some kind of almost like a Luis Suarez figure of that Liverpool that was for Liverpool, say in the 2013-14 season. But I think actually there are probably comparisons to be drawn between Liverpool of that season and Manchester United of now, in the fact that the back door is regularly open to the opposition. And I still, and I'm sorry about this, Manchester United fans, I still question Ollie's credentials as a manager going into a title race. I think, and I hold this view, that I think he's done a decent job at Manchester United. He obviously won't be replaced by Maurizio Pochettino anytime soon, so he's going to be around for quite a lot longer. But to me, there does seem to be still gaping holes in Manchester United's team, and I would worry for them. But I suppose in the week in which Tommy Doherty died, and he's remembered as a manager who brought entertainment back to Old Trafford after a very down time at the club, it's good to see Manchester United playing exciting football, and most fans are pretty happy with that at the moment.
Yeah, Barry, we do need to credit Solskjaer that, you know, he's getting a tune out of Pogba, which is, you know, a lot of people on this pod have said it should just get rid of him, and you know, joint top or second or level on points or however you want to phrase it, it's pretty impressive considering where they were.
Well, I've been having a sort of philosophical internal wrestle over the weekend, because I have to say I'm finding it increasingly difficult to question Ollie's credentials, and I've questioned them from the get-go. But he is doing an undeniably good job. I would worry about a possible over-reliance on Bruno Fernandes if something was to happen that sidelined him for a couple of months. I think United could be in all sorts of trouble. But looking down the list of players in there that started on what day was it? Saturday? Seems an awful long time ago, actually. But anyway, I suppose it's that time of year. You know, Harry Maguire is playing very well. He's turned Eric Bailly back into a decent defender. Luke Shaw, he's getting a tune out of. Paul Pogba was excellent, but he's, you know, still unreliable. And possibly the worst player on the pitch for United was Aaron Wan-Bissaka, and he still played quite well. So it was a very good performance in a game they won, could have lost. But yeah, like I say, I am finding it increasingly difficult to question Ollie's credentials.
The game was turned on that penalty, Barney, and I know you want to spend a long time on this moment. Pogba, did he trip himself? Was it a foul? How engaged were you about it?
Yeah, I mean, just don't care at all. It was awarded as a penalty, and they probably deserved to win. I mean, that wasn't really the issue about the game at all, was it? I think it's interesting that United have reached that point of joint top, and I think it's actually a function of the season in itself as well. We're talking about levelling the playing field a bit with the constraints on the season, the lack of time, the fact everybody's pushed, and I think that's kind of helped Solskjaer. I think he's not a guy with lots of big ideas. He's a guy with a few fairly sensible ideas who just wants to push the team along and who will try and make players fit and attack directly and feel good about themselves and will try to pick a fairly simple team. And I think that's actually really helped him. It's not possible for some other manager somewhere else with a far fancier idea of how they want their team to play to create the kind of momentum that will just, you know, destroy the league, which is what happened in the last few years. And I think that's really helped him, because at bottom, United have some really good players who will win games. And just pointing them in the right direction and saying, off you go, do that. We're Man United. We're Man United. Do you know we're Man United? We're Man United. That actually sort of helps, you know, the kind of we're Man United, let's go and play football. It's probably exactly the right thing to be saying in this kind of COVID difficult season. And that's clearly what he's good at. Bruno Fernandes taking a penalty in an empty stadium, you know, that will define this. That's the kind of image of this Man United era. And it's a fairly simplistic, simple thing. Somebody runs forward, they turn round, there's a bit of contact, they fall over, Bruno puts it away. And that's a very simple way of playing football. And the whole era, I find it hard to characterise them. I find it hard to understand really what Solskjaer's doing other than saying, you're good players, go and play. I find it really hard to understand why Bruno Fernandes is so good. I mean, I know he's really effective, but and I really love great footballers, but there's something about him that sort of leaves me cold. I don't really get what he's doing. He's good at kicking the ball into the goal, and he's confident and fearless, and that's about it. I can't really understand what's happening there, but it's really effective, and maybe it will take them a really long way.
Edinson Cavani has said his heart is at peace because there was no racist intent behind his use of the word Negrito in a social media post that landed him a 3-game ban and a £100,000 fine from the Football Association. He must also complete a 2-hour face-to-face online education course after pleading guilty to a charge of using insulting and or improper words. According to United, he decided not to contest the case out of respect for the FA and the fight against racism in football. Brighton 3, Wolves 3. Matt says, Barry, was Wolves-Brighton the least interesting 3-3 ever? The goals just seemed to come out of nowhere in a generally boring game.
I was surprised it wasn't higher up the billing on Match of the Day, but maybe that's the reason why. But I wouldn't say I found it boring. Good result for Brighton. It's unfortunate for them in that they scored 3 goals and still couldn't win because scoring has been a problem for them. And it was a bad result for Wolves. I would say they should have won that game.
John?
The last minute miss,
yeah,
by Owen Otasowi, is that how we're pronouncing him? A young American guy. Incredible. I mean, the thing is, it was almost forgotten because the whistle blew straight after and then you go into the post-match stuff. But good Lord above, that was a chance going begging, wasn't it? Good God.
I think he's still lying in the back of the net wondering how on earth that didn't go in.
He certainly knew the gravity of what had just happened, even if the broadcasters didn't really pick up on it. But good God. What a miss.
It is a fascinating moment for Wolves, though, because, you know, they're this kind of project team. They're lacking a really important player. And suddenly the squad looks quite thin. They're going to have to presumably buy a centre-forward. I don't know if that will presumably the super agent Jorge Mendes may be able to help them out here. Grudgingly, he'll probably find some space in the diary to help them. But it's a really, they are under a bit of pressure. I'm really enjoying this incarnation of Nuno. He looks like a sort of dying Jedi. He's got this kind of incredible dignity as he fends off he's like the Jedi. He's just about to be spiked by the Sith Lords. No, you go on, leave me here. You know, the Force will right itself, and he's dealing with it really well. But they, you know, they've bought some quite odd players, like the centre forward, the young Portuguese kid who came in to replace Raul Jimenez. I mean, he is a completely untried footballer for all his talent. Fabio Silva, he's called. And suddenly he's got to perform in the Premier League. And that suddenly the project team thing with, you know, playing this really kind of good football, I've really enjoyed them. They're going to have to really fight.
Brighton were pretty sloppy at the back, weren't they? They've conceded more own goals than any side in the top flight. Dan Byrne became the first player to score an own goal and give away a penalty in the same game since Elokim Mangala for Man City against Hull in 2014. Newcastle 1, Leicester 2. Leicester are third in the Premier League. Two lovely goals for them as well from Maddison and Tielemans. I genuinely find it difficult, Barry, to think of the interesting questions to ask about Leicester City. Is this a failure of mine? Are there lots of them? And I am, you found my, you know, it's my limitations in what is this role, asking questions about football teams. What's the interesting part of Leicester?
Well, I think it's all been covered, really. They're a very good team, and that was a pretty routine win over a fairly bad team. One thing I did note was that Newcastle, when they brought on Andy Carroll, who scored for the first time in 2 years or something, they did have Leicester under the cosh a bit, and they were kind of hanging on for the last 5 minutes. Although I did notice that I think with less than 2 minutes on the clock, the ball was lumped long to Callum Wilson, who had absolutely nobody up in support. And you're just going, what are you doing? Why isn't there someone there for him to give the ball to? But it was a pretty routine win.
Andy Carroll scored. That was his first Premier League goal for Newcastle since Boxing Day 2010. 10 years and 8 days, the second longest gap between Premier League goals for a club behind Wayne Rooney of for Everton, 13 years and 121 days. Barney.
Well, I mean, it would only be fair to point out that he hadn't actually been playing for Newcastle all that time. I mean, if he'd been playing for them for a decade without scoring, that would be a more remarkable stat. I mean, the reason you say there was no one around Callum, where was the support? The reason for that is because Andy Carroll requires three or four players to literally wheel him into place like a medieval siege tower. And they were still fixing the wooden wheels at that point. You know, his problem is obviously mobility. He's actually a fantastic finisher and a really quite an athletic guy. He's just had these injuries and he's not properly recovered from them. And once he loses his mobility, it becomes this kind of, this medieval weapon of war, which is thrilling to watch. And I was great to see him score. I'm a big fan.
Wayne says, Mark Albrighton heading while lying down versus Newcastle. Is this practiced on the training pitch? I hope so. I'm a big fan of anybody who heads the ball while lying on the floor. I thought he played incredibly well, Mark Albrighton, as we've already discovered. He's the perfect limit between underrated and overrated. He is rated exactly where he needs to be, Mark Albrighton. Palace 2, Sheffield United 0. That Eze goal, John, was just... It was. I mean, the Sheffield United defenders didn't do anything, but it was still brilliant, wasn't it?
It was. Spare a thought for Chris Wilder, though, at this point. My friend Alan Smith worked out that Sheffield United are on course for 4.47 points this season, pro rata. Chris Wilder, he's one of those managers, you get them every couple of seasons in which, let's say there's certain journalists say, well, this guy's got to be, you know, in line for the England job when it comes up and maybe he could do a great job at a bigger club. And then it all falls apart. And, you think of people like Ian Holloway, Peter Taylor. I mean, we could list loads of these managers who are and you couldn't really ever call Chris Wilder a bright young thing, but, who arrive and he seems like a classic football man. And let's not take anything away from Sheffield United's performance in their first season back in the Premier League. But I think it all went wrong at that point at which they had the goal line technology let them down in that first game back after the lockdown. Since then, it's been an utter disaster. Chris Wilder just doesn't really seem to have an answer. They've actually spent some money and they were taken apart by Crystal Palace, and it was really rather easy for Crystal Palace. And I remember Derby County back in 2007-08, they were absolutely atrocious. But yet Sheffield United aren't as bad as that, but are on course to get fewer points than that. Funny old game.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say how disappointed I am that John started talking about Chris Wilder there rather than Roy Hodgson, because I know that John has the finest Roy Hodgson in all of football journalism. I long to hear him do his Roy. It was a really nice Roy Hodgson moment, I thought. One of the things I really like about football is when you have a relationship between a young player and a really old manager. And Roy obviously really likes Eze and thinks he's a great player and has signed him and is playing him. And obviously he scored this incredible goal, which, yes, he should have been fouled and that would have been made things much better. But the way he goes past players is like beautiful to watch. It's literally, he just erases them. He's got this sort of lovely, graceful way of moving. And at the end, Roy said, he's got that little bit of extra magic. And the way he said it, his eyes twinkled. And you felt that Roy really did believe in magic. He meant literal magic. He literally loves his magic. And that was a really nice moment, I thought. And I just really wanted John to say, he's got that little bit of extra magic in his Roy voice. But it didn't happen. He talked cogently about Chris Wilder instead.
Everton 0, West Ham 1. PCB fan says, just when it seemed like Everton and West Ham were moving past Barry's label of the meh derby and on to better days, they play out one of the most meh games of the season. Will Everton and West Ham ever stop being meh, Barry?
I don't think so. I mean, after me stating confidently that Everton would definitely win the title this season because they'd finally achieved the consistency they've been crying out for for as long as I've been watching Everton after the Howard Kendall glory years, they go and lose. So, yeah, meh, the meh derby. I think it was me coined that, and I'm going to stick with that.
Yeah, it was an absolutely terrible game, wasn't it? But well done, West Ham. Good win for them. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three. Speaking of teams that will definitely win the title, well, Rangers will, won't they? And Ewan Murray will tell us all about the Old Firm in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's do a proper fit bar corner. With all due respect, Barry, of course. Ewan Murray joins us. Hey, Ewan.
How are you, Max? Good to join you. Before we start on this parochial drivel, I was interested in your Leicester City chat. Is the key thing there not whether Arsenal, Chelsea or both suddenly take a punt on, or not really a punt, but suddenly move for Brendan Rodgers, given his profile once more?
Well, possibly. No, I don't think they will, though. Man, Rodgers could go back there, couldn't he?
I think it's eminently sensible, actually. I mean, he's a proven Premier League manager. Leicester are punching above their weight. He's worked at Chelsea before. He almost got the Arsenal job before Emery got it. Sorry to step out with my kind of natural habitat, but it seems to me...
let's talk about the only thing you know about Ewan, which is Scottish football. Rangers 1, Celtic 0. Stevie says, have to give Rangers an honourable mention tomorrow, having won the Old Firm game without having a shot on target. Did they deserve it? And does that matter, really?
No, it doesn't matter at all. I mean, they won the game. The first time they've won three Old Firm games in a row for 13 years, I think. The extent to which Celtic were the better team has typically been overstated in the last few days. For the first half, Celtic were by far the better team. The first 15 minutes of the second half, Celtic were still the better team. They had near beaten sent off, and that completely changed the game in Rangers' favour. You could see the confidence, you know, leave the Celtic players' bodies immediately. Rangers, who didn't really need to win the game, given their league position, took heart from the red card. and went on in the last half hour. They were fairly comfortable in winning 1-0. It is true to say they didn't have a shot on target. It was an own goal. But Steven Gerrard said after the game, you know, no one cares. They won the game. They're in what I would think is an unassailable position now at the top of the league.
And how much would you say this is Steven Gerrard and Rangers being great, and how much is the capitulation of Celtic?
Yeah, a bit of both. I mean, we have to be fair to Rangers. They've been relentless this season. I mean, they've conceded 5 goals in 22 league games, haven't lost a league game. You know, no one needs to tell me that the league's not particularly strong, but Celtic have only lost 2 games, both of them to Rangers. They've drawn 4. I just laugh. You know, I see Phil Thompson now is saying, you know, this proves Steven Gerrard will be the next Liverpool manager, etc. Well, Rangers were bundled out of the League Cup by St Mirren 3 weeks ago, and we didn't hear anything about that because I dare say Phil Thompson didn't notice. And now all of a sudden, they beat Celtic, they're in this great league position. And listen, as I say, they're due high praise, Rangers, because they don't look like a team going to wobble at all. But Celtic's minor implosion has, of course, I mean, nothing happens in isolation, so that's, of course, played into their hands as well.
And why have they imploded?
Celtic, bad recruitment. And I touched on this last time I was on, but there's been problems in that dressing room. Toxicity, a word I could never say, but there's been elements of that within their own camp. I mean, Celtic have spent, by their own testimony, £35 million since the summer of 2019, which, you know, is, you know, not an inconsiderable amount of money. They've just spent it badly. And I mean, I find that if I was a Celtic fan, the biggest if in the world, I would be furious that Celtic have allowed their dominant position over Rangers to erode to such a point that Rangers are now, not only they've caught up with Celtic, but they're ahead of them and they're surely going to win the league. I mean, Rangers were out of the division for 4 years. Celtic had everything in their favour, legitimately, and still find themselves going to be toppled at this point in time by their City rivals. So their fans should be and are highly, highly frustrated about that.
And, you know, it takes quite a long time to win 10 league titles in a row, doesn't it? Around a decade. And to get close and not manage it, must be really annoying.
Yeah, I mean, I joke about that, about, you know, whether the achievement is a big deal or not. But it's never been done before. And so it is a hugely significant thing for that club, just as it is a hugely significant thing for Rangers this of all seasons to win the championship to stop it from happening. So, you know, and we can joke about it, but in Scottish context, the 10 thing is a big, big deal.
We should talk about Tommy Docherty, who passed away on New Year's Eve, the age of 92. Ewan, you wrote a lovely tribute to him.
Thank you. The thing that everyone knew that Tommy Docherty was a great raconteur. They know about his terrific football record. What I found quite endearing was that everyone I spoke to about him said that he was really self-deprecating in his analysis. You know, his after dinner stuff was famous, but he had that great knack of taking the mickey out of himself, and I always like hearing that about people. He didn't take himself at all seriously. And if you look at his career, I mean, his managerial career, I mean, rich and varied, barely does it justice. It was incredible where he even ended up, you know, a few jobs in Australia. Did a terrific job at Chelsea, revived Manchester United. He was an excellent Scotland manager and revived Scotland, actually. He was only in charge for 12 games. 1974 World Cup came after he left, but he was widely credited with kind of getting Scotland back on the right road. They hadn't been in the World Cup for 16 years. So he was a talented, talented guy and seemed to be fantastic. He had good company. And the other point, this is a personal point, but, you know, obviously the Manchester United physio's wife, the affair, a massive scandal at the time. He lost his job. What I thought was widely overlooked, and I was keen this didn't happen, was, you know, they were then married for 40 years. It wasn't some brief fling that caused chaos and that was the end of it. They stayed together until the day that Tommy died, which I think has to be, you know, properly recognised.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Ewan. I spoke to Tommy Docherty when I was writing a book about football managers, and I ended up reading all his various books after I spoke to him. And what struck me is what you say. He was very self-depreciatory, despite his incredible achievements. And one of those incredibly charming, nice blokes who you just wanted to talk to again. I felt like ringing him up afterwards and saying, oh, Tommy, you know, he was an incredibly nice man. And as you say, he's remembered for the, you know, the physio's wife. Well, that was his wife. They stayed together and had a long and happy marriage. And it was actually a very nice story rather than anything anyone needed to sort of hold against him or bring up. And yeah, he was one of those guys you just really liked. And that was a very brief experience of him.
I mean, he must have had, I mean, you encountered this, Barney, but he would have had stories covering so many elements of life and football. I mean, he grew up in, contrary to widespread belief, it wasn't the Gorbals. He grew up in Shettleston in Glasgow, and I don't want to say poverty, but he had next to nothing. He used to joke about that. And then he played with Shettleston Juniors, played with Celtic, his boyhood heroes, didn't work out, had a good career at Preston, Arsenal and Chelsea to follow up, not too shabby. And then the management side of things, it was, I mean, I think he was 33 and the Chelsea manager, that became a real success, international manager. I mean, there weren't many bases in football that Tommy Docherty didn't cover, actually.
I grew up in Manchester area, and by that point, Tommy Docherty was a media personality that you'd hear on local radio. Both the lads have said, you know, it'd be great company. But I think one of the good things about him as a media personality is he never pulled any punches. And, you know, I wrote a long piece actually for Jonathan Wilson's Blizzard about the managers that weren't Alex Ferguson and Matt Busby. And Doherty is almost certainly the best manager apart from them. Manchester United have had him post-war. When the fall came at Manchester United, when he fell in love with Mary Brown, he'd actually run out of people, of allies, because he'd essentially gone into the club and ripped it up. It needed ripping up, and he did a great job of that. He'd fallen out with the inner circle. So when that happened, he had to go. You speak to Manchester United fans of a certain vintage, and they will get watery-eyed when they think about the Tommy Docherty era because of the flashing blade football that Manchester United played and the pride he restored in the club at that time. It's a golden era for many United fans.
You think about it, John. I mean, it seems incredible. He got rid of Law, he got rid of Best, he got rid of Charlton.
Yeah.
I mean, that, how strong-willed do you have to be to do that? That's not done lightly, is it?
Well, yes, and there were others too, like Paddy Crerand and Willie Morgan, against whom he had a famous court case. You know, the story of Tommy Docherty, as you said, Ewan, and you've written, it's so rich and varied and so many angles to it. And as I said, one of the best things about Tommy Docherty is that he would talk about it and he would be happy to talk. And, you know, after dinner circuit, he was doing it well into his 80s, wasn't he?
Yeah, he spoke at Hampden 2 years ago for a tribute dinner, age of 90, and he spoke fantastically well, apparently. I wasn't there, but I know people who were, so... Yeah, he was still going strong and still a great storyteller.
Ewan, thanks so much for your time today.
Good to chat to you. Speak soon.
Ewan Murray, our Scottish football correspondent. We should also pay tribute to Jerry Marsden, the singer who's passed away at 78. His version of You'll Never Walk Alone, possibly the most well-known football anthem, certainly in the UK. And I was reading about it today and I didn't know anything about it, or perhaps should have done, but he was interviewed a lot, obviously, about it. And he said... on his band recording the song, he was watching a Laurel and Hardy movie at Liverpool's Odeon Cinema in the early 60s. And only because it was raining, he decided to stay on for the second part of a double feature. And that turned out to be the film Carousel, which featured that song on its soundtrack. He was moved by the lyrics, became determined it should be part of the band's repertoire. And he described how You'll Never Walk Alone was adopted by Liverpool fans as soon as it topped the charts in 1963. He said, I remember being at Anfield and before every kickoff, they used to play the top 10 from number 10 to number 1. And so You'll Never Walk Alone was played before the match. I was at the game and the fans started singing it. And when it was out of the top 10, they took the song off the playlist. And for the next match, the cop was shouting, where's our song? So they had to put it back on. And he said, now every time I go to the game, I still get goose pimples when the song comes on and I sing my head off. I don't know what any of you think. Like, I'm not we all support bad lower league football teams, and I'm not ever envious of supporting a big club, because with it comes so much expectation that you end up having a bad weekend, whereas I'm just generally surprised if Cambridge win a game. But I do feel envious, and I know it's a cliche, but when Liverpool fans sing that on a European night, does really make my, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stick up. It's a huge, it's interesting to think that he is a sort of bigger part of football history than a lot of footballers.
I do find it quite moving when I've been to Anfield. I should say actually that they do play it at Parkhead up at Celtic as well. And funnily enough, there is some sort of discussion over which group of fans sang "You'll Never Walk Alone" first, with some Manchester United fans claiming that the Stretford End sang it ahead of the Kop. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but if you watch football coverage from, you know, matches of the 70s or whatever, you know, the ITV4 show, you will hear "You'll Never Walk Alone" sung by teams that are not Liverpool. So it became a popular anthem across football until eventually, probably sometime around the late 70s, it became Liverpool's anthem, and I should say Celtic's as well.
A question from Michael, which is, why is a hat-trick called a hat-trick? Does anybody know this? Barney, you might know this.
Yeah, it's from cricket, isn't it? If you took three wickets, they would pass a hat round the crowd and people would put a florin and a groat and a five-shilling note or whatever kind of money they had in those days into the hat. Double hat-trick, of course, is four in a row, not six. And so it just comes from that. There's a class issue to that because bowlers were, you know, the bowlers were the workers, they were the farmers, and the batsmen were the gentlemen. So bowlers tended to be players. So the idea that you're passing your hat round begging because you've managed to get Lord Farquharson out, there was something very sort of demeaning. And it's sort of, class is built into cricket and English sports so strongly that even a hat trick, passing your hat, going off with the ball under your shirt, stealing the ball, is kind of, you know, it's a rapscallion thing to do. It's the fella's done terribly well, give him a hat trick. So, it's a very interesting English idea, I think.
Finally, Chris says, if the four of you had to suffer a lockdown together, who would be the last man standing? Barry, thoughts?
I think I would. I think I'm less fragile than the three of you. You would slowly drive each other mad, whereas I would just be pretty laid back and chilled about it.
Who do you think would be killed first?
Barney.
Oh, really? Why Barney?
Because he's the most annoying.
I worried I'd just start following, like he would become sort of the leader. I would just sort of fall in behind Barney and do whatever he did.
Actually, can I revise that? I think you're more annoying than Barney. I think you'd go first.
Barney, are you confident?
Well, I would never crack because I'm in lockdown all the time already. We went from tier two to tier four. Didn't notice. It means nothing to me. I never go out, never do anything, just stay in my house anyway. So it makes absolutely, you know, my life is a lockdown. The rest of you would be whining about not being able to go outside and able to do things. Fine. No difference to me. I'm unbreakable.
All right. That'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Barney.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks.
We'll be back with a Europod tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.